Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Thibaut Book Study. It's our sixth session. We're going to be continuing reading probably the most important paper in the collection, Ego Factors in Alcoholism. Wait a minute. Full title is Ego Factors in Surrender in Alcoholism. And before I start, I want to mention that there's a website associated with the study, and it's at thibaut.egbach.com, so T-I-E-B-O-U-T, and Egbach is E-G-B-O-K.com. And I've got some vocabulary words up there and a little bit of material introducing what we're going to read. So anyway, what I got up there says that we're going to back up to page 51. We have heard Thibaut has outlined for us the ego factors, or these traits of the infantile ego, that he identifies these as omnipotence, an inability to accept frustration, and a tendency to speed through life. So those are the three things that he sees in the infantile ego of the alcoholic that have to be addressed. And right at the point we're starting here, he's talking about looking at immaturity and recognizing it. So we're starting in the fourth paragraph under that heading, recognizing immaturity. It starts with let us. So I'm going to jump right in. Let us take the same trait of doing everything in a hurry and apply it to the word immature. Few will deny that jumping at conclusions, doing things as speedily as possible, give evidence of immaturity. It is youth that drives fast, thinks fast, feels fast, moves fast, acts hastily in most situations. There can be little question that one of the hallmarks of the immature is the proneness to be under inner pressure for accomplishment. Big plans, big schemes, big hopes abound, unfortunately not matched by an ability to produce. But the effect upon the adult of the persisting infantile quality to do everything in less than sufficient time can now be seen in a clearer light. The adult trait is surely a survival from the original psyche of the infant. The two other surviving qualities of the infantile psyche similarly contribute to the picture of immaturity and also indirectly help to clarify the nature of the ego with a capital E. The first of these, the feeling of omnipotence, which is feeling like I have all power, when carried over into adult life, affects the individual in ways easily anticipated. Omnipotence is, of course, associated with royalty, if not divinity. The unconscious result of the persistence of this trait is that the bearer harbors a belief of his own special role and in his own exceptional rights. Such a person finds it well nigh impossible to function happily on an ordinary level. Obsessed with divine afflatus is divine inspiration, obsessed with divine afflatus, the thought of operating in the lowly and humble areas of life is most distressing to him. The very idea that such a place is all one is capable of occupying is in itself a blow to the ego, which reacts with a sense of inferiority at its failure to fill a more distinguished position. Moreover, any success becomes merely ego fodder, boosting the individual's rating of himself to increasingly unrealistic proportions, as the king's side eagerly drinks in this evidence of special worth. So, stop there.
This is Anne.
Mm-hmm.
I find it really interesting when he talks about omnipotence and that it's associated with royalty, if not divinity, and that the unconscious result of the persistence of this trait is that its bearer harbors a belief of his own special role and in his own exceptional rights. And I don't think there's anything wrong with harboring a belief in yourself, especially having good self-esteem. I think what happens is, for me as an addict, I get mixed up. And any of my numerous addictions, alcohol, food, you know, all of them, just create even, I think, get in there and create even more mix-up for me. So it's like, I kind of think I kind of started a little mixed up in the beginning, and then when I just kind of, and because of that mix-up, I think, and adding addictions to it just takes me into this place that is extremely unhealthy. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people see a problem there with self-esteem versus what he's talking about here. But remember, the definition of the capital E ego is the infantile psyche. And the omnipotence we're talking about is an infantile trait. And so the outcome is not the result of a healthy ego. I mean, one can have self-esteem, and it's due to small e ego, right? The non-infantile, the functioning ego, the necessary ego. And but the big e ego has all of these traits. And as they play out in the adult life, we see an exaggerated sense of self-worth and an unrealistic assessment of what I can do. It doesn't make
sense. This is Karen. This Howard, that was awesome. You know, applying this, what you just read to our lives as alcoholics, one of the biggest examples that comes out to me is every time we drove under the influence, every time we drove drunk or drugged up, believing that nothing's ever going to happen to us and we're never going to hurt anybody else. I mean, that's huge, huge evidence of what we bring into adulthood with this infantile ego. And any time anyone gives us any praise for anything at all, we take it and inflate it. Just like when Bill says, you know, didn't my fellow soldiers give me an award, you know, and thinking that he was all that when he got back from being overseas. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that one little nod to us is like a coronation. I mean that's how blown up it can get. Thanks.
Anybody else want to share, or I'll start reading?
I just want to make a comment about the omnipotence. And, you know, when Tebow is talking here, I'm thinking about the magical thinking that little kids have. And it's almost like as alcoholics and addicts, like I've gotten stuck, you know, like, some of these things are developmentally appropriate if you're a younger child, but when you're like a grown woman walking around still thinking that you have special power, it becomes very problematic. That's all I want to say. Thanks.
Thank you. The genesis of all this is beyond his perception. To tell him that his reactions spring from the demands of an inner unsatisfied king is to invite incredulity and disbelief so far from the conscious mind or any such thoughts or feelings. People who openly continue to cling to their claims of divine prerogative usually end up in a world especially construed for their care. In others, the omnipotent pressures are rather better buried. The individual may admit that in many ways he acts like a spoiled brat, but he is scarcely conscious of the extent of the tendency, nor how deeply rooted it may be. He, like most people, resolutely avoids a careful look because the recognition of such inner attitudes is highly disturbing. The unconscious credence in one's such prerogative savors too much of straight selfishness to be anything but unpleasant to contemplate. I think I left out a paragraph, though. So I think I'll go back to the paragraph that I left out. The ability to administer the affairs of state, both large and small, is taken for granted. The belief that he is a natural executive placed in the wrong job merely confirms his conviction that, at best, he is the victim of lack of appreciation and, at worst, of sabotage by jealous people who set up roadblocks to his progress. The world is inhabited by selfish people intent only on their own advancement. And then it goes into the genesis of all this is beyond his perception. So people can kind of go back with their listening to the recording and kind of read that. Or would you like me to just read that paragraph again?
Yeah, you can just read it again, Suzanne.
Oh, okay. The genesis of all this is beyond his perception to tell him that his reactions spring from the demands of an inner unsatisfied king is to invite incredulity and disbelief. So far from the conscious mind are any such thoughts or feelings. People who openly continue to cling to their claims of divine prerogative usually end up in a world especially construed for their care. In others, the omnipotence pressures are rather better buried. The individual may admit that in many ways, he acts like a spoiled brat, but he is scarcely conscious of the extent of the tendency, nor how deeply rooted it may be. He, like most people, resolutely avoids a careful look because the recognition of any such inner attitudes is highly disturbing. The unconscious credence in one's special prerogative savors too much of straight selfishness to be anything but unpleasant to contemplate. Wow, he uses some really wonderful words, really great prose, I think, in explaining, like, the spoiled brat, that he's scarcely conscious of the extent of the tendency, nor how deeply rooted it may be. I mean, to me, that is like really reality. It's so real. Like, I didn't realize at all what I was doing when I was in my, actively in addiction, but even not in addiction, I don't know, I'm always not well aware of what I'm doing until I hit kind of a brick wall and am bothered about something or fearful about something, I think. So thanks for letting me read that.
This is Howard. That was a very nice perception about there's a lot more wonderful prose to come. This guy really hits his stride with this paper, not only in the content, but in the way he expresses it. What's interesting to me about these two paragraphs is, first of all, I really relate to looking at the world as a victim, right? Nobody appreciates me or, I'm being sabotaged, right? It's your fault. And that just, it's like immediate recognition for me. But the second paragraph is showing how the unconscious nature of this ego is playing out, that these traits that he's talking about are moving through into behavior and attitudes in the adult that he knows nothing about the origin. I'm sorry, I fractured that. But he knows nothing about the origin of these, of his actions, or his feelings. My feelings, were, a mystery. I mean, before I found out who I was, got a better appreciation of my character by working the steps, I had no idea that this thing was going on under the surface. And so it's his first example of this working out in somebody's, in the adult's ego, psyche and experience.
That's a really, really good way to explain it. That, I didn't know what was going on underneath. And that, for me, was really true with, like, really reading the big book closely with step one, the physical, mental, and spiritual malady, and then also, you know, just, you know, hear it says it again, you know, that I'm not really, or I personally was just absolutely not, you know, I think I have this addiction and there's all these other, there's really like all this other stuff underneath it. Thanks.
Hi, this is Karen. Oh my gosh, you know, these paragraphs just like are mind-blowing because, I mean, I'm coming up with examples from being in school and not being put in, say, the top group of learners and being highly insulted by that and believing that people are just bullying me. I mean, I believed I was being bullied by people that didn't even know my name. And I remember this now. This is my earliest memory of having these feelings that people were getting in the way of my progress. And then down here when it says, he, like most people, resolutely avoids a careful look because the recognition of any such inner attitudes is highly disturbing. I still experience that to this day with intolerance that I feel. That's my biggest struggle in recovery, and I still have a lot of judgment issues on people and different behaviors and stuff, and I still have a hard time seeing that. I mean, I recognize it today, but just knowing that it's still in there, I find it highly disturbing. So these, like, he's got us spot on. He's got us dead to rights in these paragraphs. We are just, this is it. Thanks.
Anyone else? We'll have Karen continue.
Okay, and so, for the most part, people remain happily ignorant of the unconscious drives that push them around. They may wonder why they tend to boil inside and wish they could free themselves from a constant sense of uneasiness and unsettlement. They may recognize that they seem jittery and easily excited and long for the time when they can meet life more calmly and maturely. They may hate their tendency to become rattled, but their insight into the origin of all this is next to nothing, if not a complete blank. The king lies deep below the surface, far out of sight. Inability to accept frustration. The last trait carried over from infancy is the inability to accept frustration. In an obvious sense, this inability is another aspect of the king within, since one of the prerogatives of royalty is to proceed without interruption. For the king to wait is an affront to the royal rank, a slap at his majesty. The ramifications of this inability to endure frustration are so widespread, and the significance of much that occurs in the behavior of the alcoholic is so far-reaching that it seems advisable to discuss this trait under a separate heading.
Anybody have any comments, or we can move on?
Terry? This is how I just wanted to note that the first paragraph she read is a great coda on what we were talking about before. And, you know, and what the awareness looks like when you're not, when you don't know that your unconscious is driving. You know, you may dislike the results, but you can't do anything about it.
I also like the line, it says, they may recognize that they seem jittery and easily excited and long for the time when they can meet life more calmly and maturely. They may hate their tendency to become rattled. And I think just as this is where I am a lot, especially in it's not even like in beginning recovery, but in recovery for a long time, jittery and easily excited. And what I like about this sentence, long for the time when they can meet life more calmly and maturely, they may hate their tendency to become rattled. I think that's a really nice vision statement. Okay, so Terry.
About that.
Go ahead.
So this is Lee. So what that paragraph that you just talked about, Suzanne, is the best way I can relate to that is I've always had people tell me I wear my feelings on my sleeve, and I always hated that about myself because I could get my buttons pushed real easy. Is that what they're talking about?
Am I still on the unmuted?
No, pardon me?
Yes.
Sorry, I wasn't sure if I was muted or not. It's related, if not exactly the same thing. I mean, you know, there's aspects of my character, my behavior, without a spiritual experience, and a whole lot of self-knowledge combined, that I can't change. So I end up expressing traits, that is putting them out there in the world, acting in a way that I don't like, and go back and I don't like it. So, yeah, that's one of them, right? Wearing your heart on your sleeve is one. This one they're talking about sort of being uneasy because you're not getting your due, basically.
Okay.
But it's similar.
Yeah, hi, this is Karen. It's like being highly insulted by not being recognized for the royalty that we are, and that's really the underlying thing. So, in essence, people's inability to recognize our greatness and our omnipotence does press the hell out of our buttons.
That was great. That was really funny. That our omnipotence and pushing our buttons. I think that's really true. So, Terry, next. Terry here.
As already indicated, on the surface of the inability of the king to accept frustration is absolutely logical. The wish of the king is the law of the land, and especially in the land of infancy. Any frustration is clearly a direct threat to the status of majesty, whose whole being is challenged by the untoward interruption. Even more significant is another aspect of this inner imperiousness. Behind it lies the assumption that the individual should not be stopped. Again, this is illogical if one considers how an absolute monarch operates. He simply does not expect to be stopped, as he will. So will he do. This trait, persisting in the unconsciousness, furnishes a constant pressure driving the individual forward. It says, in essence, I am unstoppable.
Any comments, or we can keep going?
This is Karen. Just a quickie on this one is, this is all about... All right, we can equate this to what it says at the bottom of page 60 up to the middle of page 61 in our book, because it's talking about needing to run the show all the time, needing to be in charge and needing everything to go our way. Sometimes we're virtuous and sometimes we're outright bastards, but either way, it has to go our way. It's like we have these giant keys and we put them on everybody's back and we wind them up and they best go in the direction that we want to go in. That's what I got out of those two paragraphs. Thanks.
Thank you. Stephanie, would you like to read next?
The The unconscious, which, oops, I just lost my page. The unconscious, which cannot be stopped, views life entirely from the angle of whether or not stopping is likely, imminent, or not at all in the picture. When a stopping is likely, there is worry and perhaps depression. When it seems imminent, there is anxiety bordering on panic. And when the threat is removed, there is relief and gaiety. Health is equated with a feeling of buoyancy and smooth sailing ahead, a sense of I feel wonderful. Sickness, contrarywise, means lacking vim, vigor, and vitality, and is burdened with a sense of I'm not getting anywhere. The need to get somewhere, to be on the go, and the consequent suffering from eternal restlessness is still another direct effect of an inner inability to be stopped or expressed otherwise, to accept the fact that one is limited. The king not only cannot accept the normal frustrations of life, but because of his inordinate driving ahead, is constantly creating unnecessary roadblocks by virtue of his own insistence on barging ahead, thus causing added trouble for himself. Of course, on some occasions, the king gets stopped and stopped totally. Illness, arrest, sometimes the rules and regulations of life will halt him. Then he marks time, complies if need be, waiting for the return of freedom, which he celebrates in a time-honored fashion if he is an alcoholic. If he's an alcoholic, he gets drunk, initiating a phase when there is no stopping him.
Anybody
that last part reminds me of my definition of freedom and how it changed after I got sober. You know, I was freedom was you can't tell me what to do, which is a direct expression of, you know, my feeling of omnipotence and I can do anything I want. And, you know, it changed after that to being, you know, free of all of these demons that I had, you know, chasing. That were really me. Freedom from drinking, freedom from trying to run the show, freedom from, you know, being able to let go, right, of things that I don't control, right. That's freedom. But before, I thought of freedom in this way.
Hi, this is Karen. Man, there's something in here that just really jumped out at me when it says the need to get somewhere, to be on the go, and the consequent suffering from eternal restlessness is still another direct effect of an inner inability to be stopped or expressed otherwise, to accept the fact that one is limited. I have worked with some heartbreaking cases with people that just cannot surrender, and they go through this, and they, going on in this, they get arrested, or, you know, the spouse gets angry, so it halts them in their tracks, and for some odd reason, they're able to, you know, regroup during that time, but as soon as the heat is off, they are back at it, and it is absolutely mind-blowing and tragic, and that's what jumped out at me from those. Thanks.
I don't know if Bob came on the line. It doesn't sound like he did, so Lee, would you like to continue?
Okay. The immaturity of such a person is readily evident. He is impatient of delay, can never let matters evolve. He must have a blueprint to follow, outlining clearly a path through the jungle of life. The wisdom of the ages is merely shackling tradition, which should make way for the freshness,
Insouciance. I'm not sure what it means off the top. I'd have to look it up.
of the ages is merely shackling tradition, which should make way for the freshness of the insouciance of youth. The value of staying where one is and working out one's destiny is the here and now, is not suspected. The 24-hour principle would be confining for one whose inner life brooks no confinement. The unstoppable person seeks life, fun, adventure, excitement, and discovers he is on a perpetual whirligig, which carries him constantly ahead, but of course in a cycle. The unstoppable person has not time for growth. He must always inwardly feel immature. Can we keep going?
Hold on just a second. Insouciance means lighthearted, unconcern, or nonchalant. So it's the kind of nonchalant attitude of youth. Yes, you can keep on going. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. This, then, is how the carryover of infantile traits affects the adult so encumbered. He is possessed by an inner king who not only must do things in a hurry, but has no capacity for taking frustration in stride. He seeks a life which will not stop him and finds himself in a ceaseless rat race. All this is part of a partial of the big ego. The individual has no choice. He cannot select one characteristic and hang on to that, shedding another more obvious undesirable traits. It is all or nothing. For example, the driving person usually has plenty of energy, sparkle, vivacity. He stands out as most attractive human being, clinging to that quality, however, merely ensures the continuance of excessive drive and ego with all the pains attendant upon a life based on those qualities. The sacrifice of the ego eliminates elements must be total, or they will soon regain their ascendancy.
Yeah, so that's that's the bottom line. He's going to talk about a lot, you know, the sacrifice of the ego elements must be total or they will soon regain their ascendancy. You know, I have to remember when I see that, you know, that looks like, you know, one order I can't go through with it, right? Total sacrifice of the ego. Well, it's big E ego he's talking about. It's that infantile ego. It's not my worth as a human being. It's not the center of my soul. It's this driving, childlike, you know, feeling state, as he calls it elsewhere, that I have to let go of entirely, you know, try, and maybe I don't ever make it, but it's a lot more possible for me to contemplate to get rid of that than it is to say get rid of all ego, which is not what he's talking about.
Hi, this is Karen. You know, one thing that I've learned about, you know, Freud's model that Harry Thibault really studied was that what happens here is that big ego sides with id. And it is a recipe for disaster because ego in its healthy state cannot live up to those demands. There is no way. And it creates this horrific situation for us. That's the simplest explanation that I've ever learned about it. Thank you.
So, could somebody explain to me what I've just read? Those few paragraphs, like where he talks about the 24-hour principle would be confining. Just that whole piece, could somebody explain it to me, what that means?
Well, I can try. This is Howard. So when he's talking about the 24-hour principle, he's hanging out at AA meetings and he's hearing one day at a time. So that's what the 24-hour principle is. That basically, you know, today is what matters, and you know, tomorrow isn't here yet, et cetera. I only have to stay sober right now. The bottom line, the basic idea. But he's talking about someone who can't work out his destiny now. He has to go forward in his thinking. And thinking of just one day would confine him, you know, because he's got this grandiosity. He's got this feeling of omnipotence. He's in a hurry. He doesn't want to be stopped. So he's not going to look at one day. He's going to look at conquering the castle, you know, the impossible goal. And doing that, he's going to run into frustration, going to be stopped. So the principle would be confining for one whose inner life brooks no confinement, right? So I don't want to be stopped. I don't want to be confined. So 24 hours is not enough for me. So I'm looking for fun and adventure. Oh, Whirligig, by the way, is like a spinning top or a toy like that, and it means kind of agitation, unpredictability. I'm perpetually in motion. You know, I'm continuously moving ahead, but in a circle, right? I'm not getting anywhere.
Right.
And no time for growth. I must always feel immature. I'm just not growing because I'm not looking at reality, which is the 24-hour thing that I think he's talking about, is, you know, being present right here and now and understanding that reality is beyond, is greater than me. You know, there's a power greater than me, and that, you know, I'm not lost in my own ego.
Okay. Thank you, Howard.
Sure.
Another part to that, this is Karen. This is a really important part. For example, the driving person usually has plenty of energy, sparkle, and vivacity. They're very attractive. There's a very attractive quality. And unfortunately, it says he stands out as the most attractive human being. Clinging to that quality, however, merely ensures the continuance of excessive drive and ego. It is a driving force, and it just causes, the idea that there's always more and more and more and more and more, that alcoholic war cry that we all have, where's mine and how much of it can I have? There's got to be more. So when it's talking about the sacrifice of the ego, elements must be total or they will soon regain their ascendancy, it has to be stopped. Like in the book when it tells us, this has to be smashed. And it's like we have to find a way to grow up and mature. And we do find that way in the work that we do.
I just wanted to say that vivacity is comes from vivacious, and it's the quality of or state of being full of energy and good spirits. I thought that was an interesting word that they used. Okay, so let's see. Howard, would you like to continue?
Okay, are we learning to live or all this is part and parcel? No, we're learning to live.
Yes, thank you.
So learning to live, those who view the prospect of life without abundant drive as unutterably dull, means you can't unspeakable, dull, unspeakably dull, and boring should examine the life of members of Alcoholics Anonymous who have truly adopted the AA program. They will see people who have been stopped and who therefore do not have to go anywhere, but people who are learning for the first time in their lives to live. They are neither dull nor wishy-washy. Quite to the contrary, they are alive and interested in the realities about them. They see things in the large, are tolerant, open-minded, not closed-minded, pulling ahead. They are receptive to the wonders of the world about them, including the presence of a deity who makes all this possible. They are the ones who are really living. The attainment of such a way of life is no mean accomplishment. Preliminary to this discussion, the conclusion was offered that the ego was a residual of the initial feeling life of the infant. It should be evident that the immaturity characteristically found in the makeup of the alcoholic is a persistence of the original state of the child. In connection with the description of the manifestations that denote a large and active ego, it should be recalled that the presence in the unconscious of such ego forces may be quite out of reach of conscious observation. Only through the acting and feeling of the individual can their existence be suspected. Wow, that first paragraph I read, I get choked up reading it. It's such a beautiful, you talked about good prose. That's pretty good. And just the ideas expressed, you know, this is what you can do living without the big E. And then he's got the second paragraph is fairly technical, right? He's talking about, so ego is the persistence of, it's the infantile ego. It comes from the child. And it's probably not available to the conscious mind. It's probably unconscious. So that's the two takeaways I get.
Hi, this is Karen. I love this. They will see people who have been stopped and who, therefore, do not have to go anywhere. But people who are learning for the first time in their lives to live, that is such a meaningful thing for, because I honestly can just have a day and have an awesome day and have it be exactly what it is. And I don't feel like I have to be constantly in perpetual motion, and that's been my life. And it is, like Howard, I was just as choked up as you. Receptive to the wonders in the world about them, including the presence of a deity, to have a God, to have an empowering, loving God to go to, and to know that I don't have to, I'm not Atlas. I mean, that's a huge thing. I'm not holding the world on my shoulders. I'm not in charge. And what a gift it is to know that I don't have to have power like that. And the ego was a residual of the initial feeling life of the infant. The feeling life of the infant is the id. And like I said before, it's like the id and the big ego are in cahoots. Thank you.
I hear a lot in the program, or there's a lot of talk in the program that, if I stop drinking, life won't be fun anymore. And I think this is so wonderful to hear a psychiatrist say that's absolutely not the case with the people that he's seen who have been successful. And I love when he says they are neither dull nor wishy-washy. Quite the contrary, they are alive and interested in the realities around them. They are the ones who are really living. I think what he says is just absolutely beautiful. Thanks.
Yeah, this is Howard. Think of the promises. When I look at that, it's not the same, but there's a lot of overlap, and it's like you said, it's wonderful to get that from a psychiatric perspective. It's unexpected and pretty wonderful.
Yeah, because he's like not one of us. He's like just kind of looking at it from the outside. To me, it's an amazingly affirming act from, you know, someone who's a healthy human being. And intelligent, you know.
Yep.
Well, healthy, intelligent, and also somebody who, you know, was really giving to be able to, you know, work and have the patience to, you know, continue to work with alcoholics who are definitely, you know, as Karen was saying before, I mean, there's so much tragedy in the world of alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll continue. Now the answer to the first question raised herein, namely, what part of the alcoholic must surrender, is obvious. It's the ego element. Life without ego is no new conception. 2,000 years ago, Christ preached the necessity of losing one's life in order to find it again. He did not say ego, but that was what he had in mind. The analysts of our time recognize the same truth. They talk about ego reduction. Freud saw therapy as a running battle between the original narcissism of the infant, his term for ego, and the therapist whose task it was to reduce that original state to more manageable proportions. Since Freud could not conceive of life without some measure of ego, he never resolved the riddle of how contentment is achieved. For him, man to the end was doomed to strife and unhappiness, his dearest desires sure to be frustrated by an unfriendly world. Well, I love how they say that what we have to surrender is our ego. I think that just kind of hits the nail on the head for me. And I like, too, the way that he take this, the beginning of the second paragraph that I read, life without ego is no new conception, and then talks about how Christ was using it in his teachings. And so it's not, it's something that people have been trying to work with for a long, long time. Thanks.
Yeah, this is Howard. Yeah, he speaks about Freud's pessimism. Freud died very bitterly. I mean, he was bitter in his mind, his expressions, as his life drew to a close, where he just lost any hope that mankind could ever redeem it. And what Thibault's saying is that he couldn't conceive Freud. Also, you want to pay attention to the case here. He's using small ego and big ego. So remember, he makes a distinction. So the analysts of our time recognize the same truth. They talk also about ego reduction. That's small ego, okay? But Freud saw therapy as a running battle between the original narcissism of the infant, so that's his big E ego, and so it's his original child feeling state with all the factors we've discussed. And that he could not conceive of life without some measure of ego, capital E. So he never resolved the riddle of how contentment is achieved. For him, man to the end is doomed to strife and unhappiness. He was extremely pessimistic before he went out, but what went off the stage. But what Thibault is saying is he thinks that Freud missed this idea of ego, you know, this method of ego reduction, and the idea that there's a way out, you know, that humankind can actually move beyond that that childish thing. So that's all.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Howard. This is Karen. You know, Freud had his own issues and was a deeply disturbed human being in the latter part of his life, and so I can see why he couldn't solve this riddle, because he had one of his own going. You know, knowing his history and stuff, and why we needed somebody like Dr. Thibault and some of the others, and Carl Jung and all of them, who came along and really helped to, you know, we've all wanted was, and the deepest desire, you know, that what the Big Book tells us about, you know, deep down within each of us is a desire to find God of some kind of higher power. We don't really want to be it. And that's really the truth. And we think we have to be. And that is the hardest thing. A lot of us who had crazy childhoods and stuff, I mean, that for me, that was the truth. I did not, the last thing in the world I wanted to be was God. But there wasn't anything else for me. So, and I honestly think that the more I read about this and the more we delve into this, that's what seems to be true. Thank you.
Wow.
Karen, would you like to continue?
I sure will. We're at In His Studies, correct?
Yeah.
On page 58. Okay, In His Studies on the Addictions, Rado more explicitly asserts that the ego must be reduced. He first portrays the ego as follows. Once it was a baby, radiant with self-esteem, full of belief in the omnipotence of its wishes, of its thoughts, gestures, and words. Then, on the process of ego reduction. But the child's megalomania melted away under the inexplorable pressures of experience. Its sense of its own sovereignty had to make room for a more modest self-evaluation. This process, first described by Freud, may be designated the reduction in size of the original ego. It is a painful procedure and one that is possibly never completely carried out. No compromise with ego. Like Freud, Rado thinks only in terms of reduction. The need for the complete elimination of ego is a stand that they cannot bring themselves to assume. Hence, they unwittingly advocate the retention of some infantile traits, with no clear awareness that trading with the devil, the ego, no matter how carefully safeguarded, merely keeps him alive, and likely at any occasion to erupt full force into action. There can be no successful compromise with ego, a fact not sufficiently appreciated by many, if not most therapists.
This is Howard. That keying into his ideas about surrender. That the surrender has to be deep and effective. We talk about deep and effective spiritual experiences.
Yeah, this is Karen. The you know, the whole you know, one of Freud's original models was that you know, the baby's born purely id, and then ego develops to be the buffer between the external world and the id, and then superego is the brakes that's supposed to tell everybody, okay, we've had enough, we're all set. And that, in people like us, in addicts, alcoholics, other people with this type of, well, you want to call it a disorder, whatever you want to call it, we don't have that. We don't have the breaks. We have a hijacking situation. We have a hostage situation, it seems. So, you know, in this, in all that we've read so far, in the studying we've done, the one thing that really rings true is once we are forced into a surrender type situation when we have nowhere else to go, the feeling of relief is that joy and that pink cloud that it's over and I don't have to try to do this anymore. That was my experience. Thank you.
This is Howard again. I, as I mentioned before, had a problem with this idea that, and it was sort of like that. What about me? I'll be the hole in the donut. In other words, a nothing. And we talked about that in an earlier paper. You know, what does nothing mean? Or maybe we did that at the book study at prime time. Too many going on at once. Anyway, the idea of nothingness, you know, as a state of being, is scary, you know, and how can I completely get rid of my ego? You know, it's my identity. See, I'm identifying with my ego. But again, he's talking about the capital E. He's talking about that persistent infantile ego. He's talking about the king baby. He's talking about the one that is demanding, you know, demanding, trying to wrest comfort from the world, you know, and make life okay as if he only manages well. That is what I can't compromise with. So, anyway, that last paragraph, the reduction sign, yeah, anyway, yes, that's it.
So I guess that's where we probably should stop. And we can, do you think it would be good to start again with that next week? Just at the top,
think,
no compromise with ego?
Yeah, yeah, it's perfect. And we only read one paragraph into it, so.
Okay, so we'll start with that. Anybody else have any other comments they want to make? Well, Terry, would you like to lead us in the Serenity Prayer?
Sure. God.
God.
Grant me the serenity. To accept a thing I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Howard. Thanks, everyone.
God bless you all. Thank you.